Today's Keshel will be on case 43 in the Book of Serenity, Luo Shan's Arising and Vanishing. Introduction. One touch of the philosopher's stone turns iron into gold. One word of the ultimate principle transforms an ordinary person into a sage. If you know that gold and iron are not two, that ordinary and sage are fundamentally the same, then after all you'll have no use for it. But tell me, what one touch is it? Luo Shan asked Yang To, when arising and vanishing go on ceaselessly, what then? Yang To shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? Whose arising and vanishing is it? Verse, severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair, a leopard covers itself with fog to change its spots, a dragon rides the thunder to change its bones, bah, arising and vanishing in profusion, what is it? Beautiful morning. This has been just a beautiful session, and I just couldn't. I mean, it's just beautiful outside. You know. I want to say once again that I'm just very happy everyone could be here, and I appreciate very much your determined efforts on the cushion. It's now the fifth day of our October 2006 session, and so after lunch we're going to be putting things away. Now if you just came here on Friday night, you might be thinking, if you've been to session before, it seems a little strange to be putting everything away on what is basically day two. It may feel good, I don't know. Now, this is more like it, right? I think a lot of people on day two of Sashin are ready to pack up. So let me just say, if this is your first Sashin, that what generally happens is that if you don't leave on day two, usually on day three, things really turn around. That's the truth. And if you talk to veterans of Sashin's past, they will tell you that this is so. You know? Usually, day one of a Sashin is a period where you're still sort of in transition between your daily life and the world of the Sashin itself. And so, you know, you're sort of thinking about your job and about this and that. And then, you know, by the end of the first day, a full day, you're usually pretty tired and your mind is really in a very placid state, even though you might be quite tired. And your body is extremely tired too. And when you get up the next day, mind is much more placid, but the body is really getting exhausted, and you have a lot of aches and pains, and also the mind may not feel particularly placid sometimes, even though it is calmer. And so day two is generally the most difficult day of the whole session. It's like the day when you're really trudging up the mountain. But if you I hope if this is your first session, you'll think about coming back, because basically if you were to stay another day, I think you'd be surprised that there's like this transformation. You know, your spirits lift, you feel brighter, you feel, and you begin to have experiences that are very powerful emotionally sometimes. You notice that you listen to the wind and that you find you're kind of tugging at your heartstrings. Or you're looking at your food and you just feel this incredible sense of gratitude. So it takes a little while for the mind to become simple and calm and placid like a body of water. Day two is usually a challenge. So those of you who are here on day two are probably going to have a little bit of a challenge today. But it's by no means wasted effort. Every time you go through this process, even if you don't complete it, you're transforming your consciousness. This is absolutely so. Every time you sit on the cushion, you're transforming your consciousness. It's absolutely so. I mean, every time you turn on TV and Arnold Schwarzenegger says, "Hasta la vista, baby," and blows away, "Consider it a divorce, boom." Every time he does that, you know, you're rehearsing anger, you know, resentment, and you might think, "Oh, I'm not paying attention," you know, but it's getting in there, and so basically, every time you sit on the cushion, you're making a change in who you are, and make no mistake about it. And every time you come to Sesshin and you go through this process, you're changing who you are, and in very substantial ways. You know, they have done, they being scientists, have done extensive research on the brain and transformation of the brain. And there's a great deal of evidence, mounting evidence, that this makes sustained and significant neurological changes. In other words, how you experience the moment really changes. This was known even back in the 1960s. One of the people I used to practice with, a guy named John Sunston, who actually came out and sat with us. Some of you might remember he came to our, he was visiting me a couple of years ago, and he came to our Zendo. I think he came to the university. He might have even gone up to when we were sitting at Bob's house. I'm not sure. I don't think that actually happened. I can't remember. But I'm pretty sure he came to the university. And anyway, he's a brain scientist. And he was teaching in the medical school. He's a neuroanatomist. And he was involved in the 60s and early 70s on some of the pioneering brain research. And, you know, they would wire up these people, these yogis in India and these Zen people in Japan. And apparently, you know, they went to this temple. I don't know if it was Daitokuji or one of them, but they went to this temple and asked that Roshi, they said, who would you say rate your students? Who are the most advanced? And so he rated them, and then they rigged up their heads with electrodes, you know, electrical sensors. And it pretty much corresponded to his distribution. He got it all right. And their brains were really performing differently. And people who do this kind of meditation a lot have what's called gamma wave synchrony, which is basically there's a state of calm attentiveness and focus on the moment. And even the hemispheres, apparently, of your brain start firing in sync. Normally, the left is going off while the right one is not, and, you know, it's just sort of like a bunch of lights flashing at different moments and so on. But in the meditative state, you know, apparently there's this, the brain's putting out these gamma waves, which are associated with a calm attentiveness, and it's synchronous. The whole brain's like functioning like blink, 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 so it's pretty cool, you know? And the experiments my friend was involved in years ago, involved these monks in the temple, and what they did was to test their perception of the moment. And so they rang a bell and kept ringing the bell to see how the brain processed the sound. And I think I'm recovering this from my memory banks accurately, but There's a phenomenon, if you've taken a psychology class, you might be familiar with it. It's called damping, or dampening, I can't quite remember. But the point is that if you hear a sound once, right, if you hear this once, you know, you register it with a great deal of attentiveness, and it's sort of at the center of your consciousness. But if I keep doing it, your mind begins to push it to the margin of consciousness, and it begins to pick out other things. So basically, you stop paying attention to this, and it becomes less and less significant to you. And basically, your mind starts moving on to other things. And what they found was that with people who were doing Zen practice, every time they heard the sound, the mind was registering it as a fresh sound. Isn't that interesting? It was registering like the first moment, every moment's the first moment. You know? That was a 30-year-old research. It was interesting that people in India were from a different tradition, and their brains weren't functioning the same way. When they were in deep concentration, they didn't register any sound at all, so that the world had disappeared from their consciousness, basically. So there's quite a difference in approach. The Zen approach is that mushin, or emptiness, is a door into something, into the universe itself. So their brains didn't function. I thought that was quite interesting. But the point is, you really are changing yourself every time you sit on the cushion, and every time you come to sesshin, you're really transforming yourself. If you keep going, you really will be changed. And I think you'll be changed. I mean, the idea is you'll be changed for the better. The idea is that the more inclusive and connected your consciousness, the more compassionate you'll be, and more attentive you'll be, and intelligent, actually. Maybe not in like IQ score, but there's a kind of intelligence which is a whole being intelligence, right? You're aware of the bigger picture, and not just intellectually aware, but aware with your kokoro, or your heart. So, you know, this is about transforming yourself and coming, even for 2 days, and in a busy schedule, that's just precious time, I know. And it's by no means a wasted effort. It's extremely important. And I really am grateful, and I really admire your determination in making the trip here. So, thank you. When you start practicing Zen, you usually have a motive which has to do with a kind of dissatisfaction with the way things are, you know? Because actually, I think the world is not really a healthy place. I mean the human world is not really a healthy place. I think a lot of values are confused or simply wrong. And the other day I was talking about the fact that when I was in college, I believe this is all like 40 years ago or something, but when I was in college, I had a friend named Tom Steptoe, whose father was a famous lawyer. There's a company called Steptoe & Johnson, and they're just a fabulously wealthy law firm based in Morgantown, West Virginia. And he was a son of this, and he was a nice kid. He actually never went to work for his dad's law firm. He actually became a lawyer, but he didn't want to be in that that environment. And so he's a small town lawyer, and he's a judge actually now. He was such a nice guy. He was my friend in college, and he used to invite me up to his house. And as I was mentioning, my parents got divorced, and they were both living in these crummy apartments, and I didn't really have a home, so to speak. You know, I would sleep on the couch of my dad's apartment, you know, when I would go home. And so, you know, going to his house was really a treat. And it was like a real house, you know, I mean, a house. And there was a mother, you know, and a father. The mother cooked. It was amazing, you know, our house was never like that, you know. I love my parents, but... So anyway, it was great to go. And anyway, one of the things he was kind enough to do, he said, do you want to go up and look at the Trappist monastery? There was a Catholic Trappist monastery there. And we drove up there and spent the day, actually, and did some chores, as I recall, and hung out with the monks who weren't allowed to speak. There's a guy who was there like an outside man who mediated and could have done all this stuff, but they had taken like a vow of permanent silence, I guess. Probably they might not do that now, they've sort of liberalized it. But at any rate, I was really impressed by this because my life was just so totally nuts. You know, it was just so, totally crazy. As I said, my family life was just like an ocean of unhappiness. I mean, my parents were not mature people when it came to parting their company. And then my mother threw a coffee cup at my dad, and they'd said yelling battles out on the lawn and stuff like that. It was just awful. And it was very depressing for me to see people I love behave so terribly. It was very disorienting too, because, you know, really it would be like, you know, at the end of the semester and everybody would be going home, and it was really, I could go sleep on my dad's couch, or I could go sleep on my mother's floor, you know. And it was just, you know, so that was going on. And actually, college is a very exciting time, but it was also a very weird time, you know. This was like the early 70s and late 60s. And people were crazy, really, you know, when I think back on it. It was just like cars were driving in the street with like clouds of marijuana coming out the window, and people were weird, you know. They were weird, they were insensitive, they were very open, but they were also very insensitive, you know. Just because you have long hair and you have bell bottoms doesn't mean you're a nice guy, you know. You can smoke dope and be just the meanest guy in the world, and the peace and love spirit, it didn't really, you can say peace and love, but that doesn't really transform your heart, right? So there was a lot of confusion, a lot of real serious confusion, and people were, I think, quite insensitive to one another sometimes, even though it was supposed to be a golden age. And it was just, I was very mixed up. And of course, as I mentioned, we were at war with Vietnam, and that was a nightmare because we were inflicting so much suffering on those people. So when I went up to this monastery, this Trappist monastery, it just seemed like, this is where I want to go, man. I want to go here. And I am not from the Catholic background, but I was ready. You know, if they had let me live there, I would have probably stayed. But then, you know, they said, "Well, are you a Catholic?" And I said, "No, I have to be a Catholic to get in here." And no. And they said, "Yes, you know." And I said, "Do you have to believe it?" "Yes." So I began to read up and thought, no way, you know, for me, this just wasn't my thing, you know. So, it's like the Pope, right? It's the orders from the Pope, you know. So I just, with all due respect, it's a beautiful path, but it just wasn't my path. But I really craved that. And when I came to Zen, you know, when I came to Zen finally, it was like the monastery I wanted to go to but couldn't go to, you know. And the Zen Center was not really a monastery originally. It was just a building where people practiced, you know. And it didn't really have a residential component. But, it was just heaven. You know, when I began to sit, I didn't leave the world, but I had peace. You know, and when we go on Sesshin, it was like this wonderful, beautiful peace. And that feeling of being really being liberated from all that madness is just wonderful. It's just the most sweet, beautiful feeling in the world. Infinitely precious, I think. But it's possible to misunderstand Zen practice in a way if the story stops there, you know. If the story stops there, it's like one of the books I read was by a man named Thomas Merton, who was a Trappist. He wasn't at the monastery I went to. He was one in Kentucky. He was at a monastery in Kentucky. But he took a vow of silence, and when he finished college and became a brother, I can't remember, but it wasn't Thomas. He took another name. And basically he worked on this monastery where they make grape jelly, actually, and other foods, sustain themselves financially. Work is part of their practice. And I read this book, and it ends with his basically entering the monastery and taking orders. And the book ends with that, you know. So it's like a journey, as I recall, it's been, 40 years, so I might be wrong, but, or 38 years. It's a journey from confusion to certainty and from chaos to peace, right? And the book, and then I found peace. Last page, the end. And it's possible to see the spiritual journey, if you want to call it that way, and it is wonderful to find that stillness and peace that we achieve in Sesshin. It's wonderful. But you have to ask yourself, let's say you did quit your job or put aside your life, and you did go into a monastery, and you did. Now, if you decide that this is the thing you want to do, I applaud it. I think it's a wonderful decision. And there are training temples in the United States where you can go. But the interesting thing is that Thomas Merton's life didn't stop at the end of the seven-story mountain, the last page, and then I found certainty and peace. Right? Merton took a vow of silence, but at some point he realized he really had to write, So even though he was silent, he wrote thousands of pages, right? So that's interesting, isn't it? He was committed to silence, but he sure used words a lot. That's not necessarily hypocrisy, see? It's complexity. It's complexity. And Merton himself, when he entered the monastery, was so in love with the traditions of the monastery, the ancient traditions. And by the end of his career, he was fighting it out with the hierarchy in his monastery. And he had arguments with the head of the monastery, who thought he was wasting too much time on his writing projects. And it became complicated because Merton, he got very involved in worldly affairs, right? He wrote a criticism of the Nixon administration's war in Vietnam. He went to Asia, and he met Buddhist monks and said, yeah, I really like these guys. And that frightened many people in his own religious order, because he was very broad-minded about the inner life. And he actually wrote in one of his last books, he said, I'd like to come and train with one of these Tibetan teachers. So he was a controversial figure. In other words, his story didn't end with finding peace. There's more to life than that. See, if we once we've found that stillness and that peacefulness, if you hold on to that, you create new obstacles. And the world outside of the Sesshin is so divided in so many ways, right? Republican against Democrat, this against that, It's so violent, and it's so unhappy a world in many ways, and so you get in into a deep samadhi and you enter this stillness, and you think this is so healing, and it is, it's so sustaining. But you can't stop there, you can't stop there. You know, basically, if you do stop there, your world is cut in two again, right? You're clinging to something all over again, right? You're not clinging to like material possessions or status. You're not clinging to, whatever is your addiction, your addictions and all. You're clinging to peace, that peacefulness, and serenity. Please don't do that. When people practice the breath perception koan, their goal is to reach that state of that, what I described yesterday. I said, there's a place in your breath, you follow your breath, it's like the eye of a tornado. It's so serene. And literally, World War III could break out, and if you're in deep samadhi, you just go, oh well, that's where it goes. And that's wonderful. It's absolutely essential to have that peace, that imperturbable calm. But if you cling to it, you can create a new obstacle. And this is why samadhi is not enlightenment. When you can enter a beautiful samadhi state on the cushion, you're sort of like in bliss, right? It's so wonderful. And at that point, the teacher has to say, hey, time for the next koan, right? And a lot of times people, they want to pass their next koan, but it's kind of like, but I really love that blissful state, right? And then you have to do mu, and it's so hard, and it's dark in there, and it's difficult, and my legs hurt, and it goes on and on, when is it, I've been doing this koan for so many years. Albert Lowe, who is the teacher in Montreal, I believe the Montreal Zen Center, he has a book of koans that he comments, in the Mumonkan, he comments on the Mumonkan, and he said, when I did the Mu koan, it was like 4 years sitting in the cold and the dark, and that's true, But eventually, you realize that there's more, there's something more than stillness and peace, right? There's something more than stillness and peace. And if you're clinging to stillness and peace, you won't be able to learn what the koan is trying to teach you, In other words, there's the universe has an aspect as a pure stillness and peace. But another aspect of the universe is energy, right? And that these two things go together, wouldn't you say? We Zen people aren't afraid of stillness and peace. We aren't afraid of emptiness. And we aren't afraid of form, right? Because form is actually emptiness, and emptiness is actually form. In the middle of all this energy, there's imperturbable stillness. And this stillness is like a little engine pumping out waves of universal energy, life energy. This is the whole thing, the whole enchilada, as they say. It's easy to get caught up in the beauty of samadhi, a so-called samadhi state. And it's also easy to get caught up in the peacefulness of things. So, for many years I had this experience myself. I'd go to Sashin, and we used to have Sashin often at this Baptist summer camp out on the Hood Canal. And it was so beautiful. I mean, first of all, you had to take a ferry boat to get to the island where, this is like, and it was beautiful. Washington State probably has a smaller population than New Jersey, and it's about 10 times the size, or maybe 8 times the size. And when you take a ferry over, it's not like the beach, it's not like the Jersey Shore, right, where there's houses all along. It's no houses, and there's an occasional house, and it's all trees, right? And there's eagles, you know? And there's whales. No, I'm not kidding. You know, there's orcas, and they're, you know, tooting at you and stuff like that. Really, there's orcas in the water, and, you know, eagles in the trees. And then you get over to this island, and, you know, it's beautiful country roads, you know, farms, if that, mostly just trees, you know. And we get out to this place that looked over a channel, natural body of water. And basically the Zendo had a big window and we looked out over this. It was just so beautiful. And I go to these sesshin, and it's true, I had a lot of pain and difficulty for many years, but eventually I would, you know, be so still and peaceful. And then I'd get back to my life, and it was just like back in the center of Seattle. You know, I mean, even to go to sit in the morning, our temple was in South Seattle, so we had to drive down. And you had to go by the Rainier Brewery on the major artery. And it was always like bumper to bumper coming back. You know, so you'd go to sit, and then we'd have to drive back. And my job was at the university, and there'd be traffic. And I had like an early class, and I'd be thinking, oh, God, I've got to get early for class. Oh, no. Oh, no. So it's like back in the swim, you know, back in the pot, and the boiler is on, right? You know? But... you know, if you live that way, you have you're living in a divided world. You know, you want to make that stillness the foundation of your practice, but at a certain point, you can return to the world of form, and you can embrace the energy of that world. You can embrace it. You know, it's not really chaos. See, it only looks like chaos. It's just huge. You know, and so you can harmonize yourself with the unfolding of the universe in its active manifestation. See, and this is possible to do. It's like, I'm not kidding, there is such a thing as like paper grading samadhi. You know, I'm not kidding, you know. But when I'm grading papers, you know, I can just get into the flow. And I feel the energy. It's like I feel this dynamo turning in my body, and I'm just grading papers, you know. And I have a single-minded focus. You know, I just my well-trained mind is just focused, you know. It's like being in the groove when you're sitting on the cushion, you know. And you know, if you have to write memos, you can come in and go, oh God, memos, you know. Another memo, you know. And you can say, boy, I wish I were back at Sesshin where there's no memos, you know. It's so great, you know. These damn memos. But, you know, you can get into memo writing samadhi, you know, really and truly, where you really get into it. And you know, when I'm in that state, you know, I don't even hear people talking. They come in, I come in, if I have something like that to do, I come in and I see my secretary, Judy, and I say, hi, how's it going? And then I go in and I start working, and I'm like intensely concentrating. And I'll come out and I'll see her and I go, hi, how's it going? And I go back in, you know, hi, how's it going? It's like, it's like a joke, right? You know, every time I see her, it's the first time. It's that brainwave, right? But I'm in samadhi, you know. I'm in my samadhi, you know, memo writing samadhi or paper grading samadhi. And this is a less divided way to live. You know, this is actually a very powerful way to live. You know, is this harmonizing the dynamic, or harmonizing the your emptiness with the world of form in your body, in your mind and heart. And this is a really important part of practice. This is a crucial moment in your practice. It may not be possible to do this right now, but this is definitely on the horizon, definitely part of the agenda. Now, if you have a job that you just hate, you know, and it sickens you to go into work, then you should change your job, right? Because you can't really get into memo writing if you're working for a place you really hate, right? Or that's not an honest place, or not a, you know, supportive place. You can't really get into a wholehearted embrace of what's going on, right? But if you're a waiter in a restaurant, you can get into waiting samadhi, right? Really and truly. You can really get into it. When I was a cook, I mentioned that one of my jobs was cooking in an Italian restaurant. The way it works is that there'd be all these waitresses out on the floor, and we didn't have any waiters at this place. They would all come in with their orders, and they would, they had them written down on a piece of paper, and there was a big wheel, and it with little clips on it, like a little tiny stainless steel clothespins. And they'd come in and say, "I'm hanging two lasagnas and a ravioli," or "I'm hanging a porterhouse steak and two manicots," And then, the cooks have to look at, whoever is online at the time. You look at the order, you put the stuff in the oven, you throw the steak on, whatever you're cooking. You've got to be on top of it, right? And the way a restaurant works is that nobody's in the restaurant, right? And then suddenly there's 100 people, right? So you're sitting there thinking, and then all of a sudden, like, hanging, and then, they're all, and I'm pulling, and so they hang the order, you're supposed to put it in the oven or put it on the grill, whatever, and then they're going to serve the salad and the soup and take the drink order, and then, at that point, they're supposed to come in and go, "I'm pulling," and you're supposed to have it all ready, right? If you screw up, they go ballistic because they're not going to get a tip, And it's like there's 100 different orders hanging, and you're not the only, there's two cooks in this place. So it used to get me down, and there was this guy who was the chef there, his name was Bill Garrison, and he could just sail through this stuff. He could just, it was just like effortless, and he had a very good memory, and he was so smooth. He was in the flow. There is such a thing as flow. He was in the flow. And he would just, one time we had a banquet, and we had like 100 people or 150 people coming. And he just, we were all sort of cracking up because it was just so, and he just, put it, he sort of delegated all the jobs. He came right in and it was just effort. And he had it all, and he had done this hundreds and hundreds of times, right? But he had that samadhi. He had that, chef's samadhi, and there's waiter's samadhi, and there's cook's samadhi. There's a kind of flow in action. It's a stillness in action. It's a stillness in action. See, you're serenely moving 100 miles an hour. And that's possible to do, I swear to you. And, that's really, and when it happens, you can feel it. It's all of a sudden, occasionally you just step back and realize, whoa, this is really gone. This is really gone. And it doesn't mean there aren't problems, but you're in the flow. And by the way, people have studied this. Psychologists have studied this phenomenon. There's actually a book called Flow. Really. And this psychologist is talking about how people who are, who do certain kinds of jobs very well, find a way to get it. They often talk about the fact that, I'm not doing it, it's just unfolding, I'm just along for the ride, I'm enjoying the, that's how it feels. It's like, I'm not doing it, the universe is doing it, right? And this happens all the time, if you poets and creative people often talk about this. They'll say, I don't know how this piece of music, I sat down and out it came. I was just in the flow, I was sort of taking dictation. It doesn't always happen like that. But sometimes it really is like that. And even people who are revisers, Mozart, when they looked at his scores, it's interesting, I heard on the radio that musicologists look at Mozart's original scores, and it is like he was taking dictation from the universe. There's no erasers, there's no changes, it's just like boom, and it all came out. It's like amazing, in the flow. And they say that Beethoven wasn't like that. He starts out with like a really primitive melody, and then he just keeps revising and revising, and it gets better and better. But that's a kind of flow too, right? He's in reviving flow, you know. There's really something to this. You have different styles of working, but you can get into the flow, and you're just say it's like I'm not doing it. The universe is doing it, right? And that's how it is when we sit, right? When we're sitting on the cushion, sometimes you don't feel like you're making the breath come in and out. The breath is just coming in and out. You don't know how it's happening. It's like it's just happening. You know, it's like you're being breathed, right? And when you're really in Mu Xin, you know, you're not really conscious. It's just happening. It's like it's all unfolding and you're along for the ride, right? See, that's really the dynamic aspect of this practice. And so it is true that if you don't sit, people say to me, how can I integrate this into my everyday life? And what I usually say is, do zazen, right? Because you can't not do zazen and then try to be mindful in the moment, you know, like when you're driving, I'm meditating as I drive. It's like, well, actually, you're mindful when you drive, but you're not meditating. In order to meditate, you have to sit on the cushion, use your whole body, watch your breath. There's no substitute, right, and you can't, you know, try to be mindful in the sense that you're having a cup of coffee and go, hey, I've got to be mindful of this coffee. You know, this is real coffee, isn't it, you know? See, that's very artificial, right? So you've got to do your zazen. But if you do your zazen and you get off the cushion, try to kind of embrace the moment as it's unfolding. You have kind of an open heart, right? You can find yourself suddenly in the samadhi. You're sort of like taking those orders, you know, and serving that food, or you're playing that music, you know, or you're writing that memo, or whatever you have to do, you know. And problems too, you know, a problem is not an obstacle necessarily, you know. When you're working on a problem, you can be in the flow too. You know, you don't have to have the answer to be in the flow. You're working, like Beethoven, he didn't know where he was going, but he was in the flow. He was, take this melody and do this to it, and then do that to it, and see where that went, and do that, and that, and that. Pretty soon it's, you know, a great symphony. So you don't have to have the answer to be in the flow. Being in the flow is a really important part of Zen practice. And, you know, I'm almost out of time, but, you know, when you feel that the universe is acting through your body, you know, it happens sometime when we sit, it happens sometime when we're off the cushion, that feeling like everything is just working out, you know, everything, doesn't mean it's all going smoothly, see, that's the, when you feel connected to things, to the world, it's like you're part of something larger unfolding. When that happens, and you feel, you know, this, you're sitting on the cushion and nothing's happening, and then all of a sudden you just have this thrill of energy or this explosion of joy. This happens to people, right? And you hear birds sing and you feel so connected. It's like I'm part of this whole thing, this whole beautiful device, this whole beautiful universe is unfolding. That joy that arises in your heart when you sit sometime is from your connectedness. The boundaries of the self drop away and you feel connected. And when you feel connected, you feel joy. And you feel this tremendous sense that everything, you know, that everything's unfolding around you. And that you may not consciously think any of this, but this is what one way to understand what's happening. When the barriers go down, there's this joy because everything is part of your life, and you're part of this whole life, this big life. So this is really how we Zen people live. When we talk about true self, this is what it means, you know. Practice today, you know, don't worry about consequences. Just practice wholeheartedly. And let me just say, don't set too high a standard for yourself. You know, that's one of the ways people prevent themselves from being in the flow, see. If you're too much of a, you know, Remember that the Buddha taught the middle way, right? There's a kind of way of practicing which is like this. You pull your legs up over your thigh and you say, damn it, I'm going to die before I move, right? And you sit there and you're... And then there's another person who's just like, when's lunch? You know? I think I'll have a stretch, you know, a little stretch. So those are the extremes, right? What the Buddha said was, you know, whenever you don't know what to do, try to identify the extremes and then pursue the middle way, right? The middle way. So there's a way of practicing which is too loose, not trying hard enough. And there's a way of practicing which is too tight, too tight. So, you know, if you set too lofty a goal, if you say, I'm gonna pull these legs up and I'm gonna sit three sits and come hell or high water, you know, and you might just be tired that day, right? And, you know, you get through the second sit and it's like your legs are burning and your teeth are chattering, you know. And you know, I can't back down. I'm a Zen failure, right? You know, this is like not productive, in my opinion. This is not a productive state. You've set too high a goal and now you're not pursuing the middle way. You're falling to the extreme, right? So you have to sort of you try, but don't try, you know. So then when you get into the flow, you know, you're sitting and you feel good and you're going with the flow and the bell rings for the first sit of the morning and you think, damn, that was good. You know, I'm not going to stop. See? And you just keep going. You go through the next one and you think, wow, this is amazing. I'm going to keep going. See, that's perfect. I mean, you're pushing yourself, but you're not pushing yourself too much. You're not pushing yourself too much. You're in the flow and you're going with the flow. And sometimes you can't be in the flow all the time. You know, so you might get through the second sit and think, yesterday I got through three sits, but today I just can't do it. Or yesterday I sat full lotus and what's wrong? I'm going backwards. You know, I'm deteriorating. My practice is, you know, I'm getting worse. You know, oh my God, everything's caving in on me. You know. So don't do that to yourself. It's a common human thing. But it's really not possible to get worse if you're practicing. There's different. It's really not. You know. So basically, maybe you're tired. You know, we can't be perfect every moment. So, you know, if you look at certain people in the Zendo, they seem to be effortless practitioners. You know, but the truth is, you know, they've been practicing a fairly long time. You know, so set a realistic goal for yourself, and when you're in the flow, go with it, baby. You know, enjoy it. It's beautiful. And you're not in the flow all the time, and that's okay. If you don't try hard, nothing's going to happen. But if you try too hard, nothing's going to happen. You're just going to make yourself miserable. You know, it's possible to go through a sesshin. You know, I went through my first sesshin almost entirely full lotus after maybe 10 years of practice. You know? And yet at the end, I myself got, you know, so tired, I did break some sits, you know. And I went away from the sesshin feeling so bummed out, right? This is called snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, right? It's like instead of going home and saying, wow, I almost did the whole sesshin, you know, a full lotus. My God, what an, you know, I went home thinking, oh, I'm no good. And I'm just crying. I'll never amount to anything. What a moral failure I am, and so on. So don't do that. You know, find that middle way, and try that in your life too. You know, try that when you leave here and you go back to your work. You know, look for the flow in your actions. Look for the flow. but try to lose yourself in the flow of action. This is a kind of moving meditation or everyday meditation. But don't make this distinction between stillness and action. That's an arbitrary distinction. Luo Shan asked Yan To, when arising and vanishing go on unceasingly, what then? Yan To said, shouted. He shouted and said, whose arising and vanishing is it? It's so beautiful. The true self. True self. True nature. It's true nature on the cushion, true nature off the cushion. Always the same. Great life. Severing old entangling vines, opening up a fox lair. See, you get off the cushion, what do? You untangle the vines. You open up a fox lair, see? These are difficult things to do, right? It's hard to find a fox's lair. It's hard to keep track of the leopard, who in mythology, he surrounds himself with fog to change his spots. The dragon rides the thunder to change his bones. These are all symbols of transformation, of dynamic transformation. See, so that you can be a leopard, you can be a fox, you can be a dragon. That's really a wonderful way to be. So we have a few more hours of this wonderful, beautiful, precious practice. Let's walk that middle way together, okay?